Well, our next guest on Downtown has been a writer for Grantland and many others, and has got a brand new book out that is absolutely fabulous. It's called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me, What Pop Music Rivalries Reveal About the Meaning of Life. Stephen Hyden joins us this afternoon. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I'm glad to have anybody who is blessed, as you say, with the pure athleticism of Jeffrey Tambor.
Well, you know, I don't like to brag, but it's a fact.
The book is absolutely fantastic. You look at some classic rivalries in the music world, some new ones, some perhaps imagined ones. And most of these rivalries are not about the artists, right? They're about us. They're about the listeners.
Yeah, I mean, the rivalries that I wrote about, I wanted to make sure that there was some conflict between the principals, you know, even if it was like one incident, you know, like with Kanye West and Taylor Swift, for instance. It's mainly about that incident at the 2009 MTV Video Music Awards, where Kanye West took the trophy away from Taylor Swift, and it was a big controversy. But yeah, like you say, I'm more interested in like what exists in the public's imagination and like what we project onto these things and why we care so much about it.
Is it okay for us as listeners to change sides in these rivalries as we age?
Yeah, I mean, I think in a way that's part of, you know, the progression of life. You know, it's certainly the progression in this book, I think, in a way, about how your perspective changes a lot as you grow older. And for me, as it pertains to rivalries, you know, like when I was younger, I was much more about arguing with people about music and drawing lines in the sand and, you know, kind of defining myself against what I perceived other people were like. And now that I'm older, I'm much more interested in connections and, you know, trying to see, like, what I have in common with someone, even if they don't seem to be like me at all.
Is it acceptable or even encouraged to dislike artists because of the people that they attract?
You know, I don't know. I don't know if it's acceptable. I don't know if I'd use that word. I feel like that's something that happens quite often without us even realizing it. Mm-hmm. You know, I feel like when we talk about music, a lot of times we talk about it, you know, in terms of high school. Like when people are young, they'll gravitate to certain kinds of music because maybe they want to be a certain kind of person. Like if you're into heavy metal or something, there's a whole set of clothes and attitudes that go along with being a fan of that kind of music. But, you know, now in the social media era, you know, people curate their online personalities for public consumption. And part of how we do that is with the music that we say we like and the TV shows and movies and all that. And I find that that continues well into adulthood. You know, I see that all the time on Twitter and Facebook with grown people talking about that kind of stuff. So I'm just really interested in that phenomenon.
We're talking with Stephen Hyden. His book is entitled Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. Let's talk about some of the rivalries. We were chatting last hour about the Hendrix-Clapton comparison and the fact that maybe, as you point out, Clapton suffers because he had the opportunity to fade away and not burn out.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that's an old cliche about rock music that if you die young, that can be the best career move that you can have. And that's sort of a morbid thing to say, but when we talk about people like Jimi Hendrix or Jim Morrison or even like Kurt Cobain, it is true that like when you have a small body of work and you're sort of fixed at that magic age, like in your mid-20s, you know, before you have a chance to get fat, get bald, and, you know, to make mistakes, you know, you get preserved at sort of an ideal time, and that's how people remember you. Whereas, you know, if you have a long life and a long career, there's peaks and valleys, and, you know, people might judge you for that reason. So, yeah, for me, that rivalry was fun to write about just because, like you say, it was, to me, a defining example of that burnout versus fade-away dilemma.
I was really fascinated, too, with the chapter on Pearl Jam and Nirvana and wound up, at the end of that chapter, feeling a little sorry for Eddie Vedder.
Yeah, I mean that chapter, I wrote a lot about hero worship in that chapter because, you know, Eddie Vedder was an admirer of Kurt Cobain, and yet Cobain repeatedly slagged Pearl Jam in the press. in the early going. And, you know, there may have been a sense, I don't know if jealousy is the right word, but, you know, Pearl Jam became much more popular than Nirvana in the early 90s. I mean, they were just a huge selling band. So there might have been some sense of competitiveness maybe going on, and maybe that's what fueled Cobain to say those things about Vedder. But, you know, again, that kind of goes back to what we were talking about with Hendrix and Clapton, that idea of, you know, are you going to burn out early, or are you going to find a way to continue on and to sustain yourself? And that, to me, kind of defines that Pearl Jam Nirvana dichotomy in a way.
Now, I have to say, I found myself at the end of the chapter on Jack White and Dan Auerbach kind of disliking both of them, at least personally, as I looked through that window.
Yeah, you know, that's a funny one, you know, because you have Jack White, of course, with the White Stripes. You know, White Stripes were a huge band in the 2000s, and they sort of, they didn't invent the two-person lineup. There were other two-person bands before the White Stripes, but they certainly popularized that kind of format. And then the Black Keys come along, and Jack White feels that, you know, the Black Keys stole his act, basically. And the Black Keys have obviously done very well. They've made a lot of money doing that. So, you know, there's been a conflict for that reason. But, yeah, for me, what that was really about, or what I see that as, is like how men have difficulty relating to each other a lot of times, and how instead of, you know, bonding over this kind of shared thing that they have, being these two blues guitarists, you know, in a modern context where there aren't a lot of blues guitarists, they turned it into a competition. And I don't know, that just struck me as a very sort of male thing to do. And so I thought it was interesting for that reason.
Can you talk a little bit about the idea of what you call the default smart opinion?
I mean, I just feel like, you know, maybe to, you know, to get back to that, you know, talking about the social media era that we live in now, you know, there's people have so many opinions, and you know, you're inundated with opinions all the time. And I feel like, you know, the default smart opinion to me is the thing that people just repeat because it sounds smart, and they know that they won't be challenged for it if they say it, but it really doesn't mean anything. It doesn't really reflect any kind of thought. So, like, for instance, when you hear people complaining about the Kardashians, like they call Kim Kardashian stupid or whatever, or shallow. I'm not saying that she's not those things, but I, you know, to me, it's just an example of something that people just repeat because they heard someone else say it, and it's a way that they feel like will make them sound intelligent if they just repeat it. So, I think that's an interesting thing that seems to be prevalent now.
The book is laugh out loud funny. There's some great lines in there. I laughed out loud when you recounted your experience about taking shrooms and eating the bark off a tree, and you said you turned into a cross between a squirrel and Greil Marcus, which was just brilliant.
Well, yeah, because I was listening to Bob Dylan at the time, and it was the Royal Albert Hall bootleg from 66, and that was back when it was still a bootleg. It's been released now subsequently, but that was like the show where someone yelled Judas at him, you know, because he's playing electric.
Right.
And, I was under the influence of chemicals, as you say, and it was a very emotional experience. So, yeah, you know, I'm glad I went through that because 20 years later I could write about it in a book.
There you go.
It paid off.
Speaking of writing, is it safe to say from reading this, because much of this is very autobiographical, that you became a writer to avoid having to ask girls to dance anymore?
Well, you know, Frank, you know, fortunately my wife thinks it's cute that I can't dance. So I think that's the secret for guys out there. Like if you're a young man and you're a bad dancer, or you're shy and you don't want to ask girls to dance, you will hopefully eventually meet a woman who will find that endearing. So I was able to do that, and I've lived happily ever after, ever since.
Stephen Hyden's book is called Your Favorite Band is Killing Me. A couple of great stories from the book. Can you talk a little bit about the epic ping pong battle between Prince and Michael Jackson?
Yeah, well, you know, of course, Michael Jackson and Prince, two of the biggest pop stars of the 80s, and, you know, we've been talking a lot about Prince lately, obviously, because he sadly passed away. But, yeah, there's a story in the book. You know, I have a chapter on their rivalry, and there's a story about how when Prince was filming Under the Cherry Moon, which was the follow-up film to Purple Rain, he invited Michael Jackson to visit the set. And when Michael Jackson showed up, Prince was in the middle of playing ping pong. So he invited MJ to play with him. And Michael Jackson was very tentative about playing with Prince, whereas Prince was really competitive. Like, he really wanted to beat Michael Jackson in this game. And finally, you know, they're kind of hitting the ball softly back and forth. And then finally, Prince hits the ball as hard as he can. And the ball hits Michael Jackson in the man region. And, of course, that's very embarrassing for Michael Jackson, and he ends up leaving shortly thereafter. And as soon as Michael Jackson leaves, Prince was just gloating hardcore about this. And he said to his friends that Michael Jackson played ping pong like Helen Keller. So, yeah, not the nicest thing to say, but, you know, it kind of humanizes these people a little bit, you know, that these two great icons of music, and yet, you know, Prince really cared about this ping pong game.
You also talk about your own Bruce Springsteen dream, and then the dreams that clearly Chris Christie has about being his buddy, and the boss just wants no part of this.
Yeah, you know, and that was in the Nirvana Pearl Jam chapter, you know, again talking about the idea of hero worship, because, you know, with Chris Christie, you know, I'm opposite him politically, and I don't really agree with him on a lot of things, but when it comes to Bruce Springsteen, like, we're on the same page. Like, I love Bruce Springsteen so much, and Chris Christie is, like, a legitimate Bruce Springsteen fan. He's not, like, one of these politicians that just pretends to like some artist, you know, in order to get votes. Like, he's been to, like, over 100 shows, and I think there was a video of him recently dancing at a Springsteen show.
So, I saw that, yeah.
He's a serious fan, but, like, Springsteen wants nothing to do with him. Like, he will go out of his way to sort of diss Christie. And I don't know if you remember this, but, like, when Chris Christie was going through that Bridgegate scandal, Bruce Springsteen went on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, and he did that sketch where Springsteen and Fallon sang a song about Bridgegate and basically making fun of Chris Christie. And, you know, that part of me that's a Springsteen fan, I sympathize with Christie in that moment, because I can't imagine what it would be like to have Bruce Springsteen make fun of you. I mean, it'd be like Abraham Lincoln making fun of you or something, you know? It just seems like the most humiliating thing. So in that narrow respect, I have a lot of sympathy for Christie.
And I love the story about Axl Rose and how for a while we thought Axl Rose was a tough guy, but maybe it took a Tommy Hilfiger to let us know that's not the case.
Well, yeah, I mean, I have this chapter in the book on celebrity boxing matches. You know, like, and I think, I mean, this happened more in the 80s where rock stars would challenge each other to box in public, like for charity. You know, and none of these boxing matches ever took place because rock stars, for the most part, are all talk. You know, they're not really tough guys. But, you know, they would talk a good game in the press and then sort of back down the road. And Axl Rose was the master of this, because there were numerous instances, like, where he would, you know, basically pledge that he was going to kick somebody's butt, and then he never did it. And the most famous example is him and Vince Neil. Of Motley Crue, almost, you know, he was going to box Vince Neil because Vince Neil punched out Izzy Stradlin from Guns N' Roses at, like, the 89 Video Music Awards. But, yeah, the Tommy Hilfiger thing that you referenced, there was this story, like, 10 years ago, like, where Axl Rose and Tommy Hilfiger were in a bar, and Axl Rose, like, moved Tommy Hilfiger's drink. He moved Tommy Hilfiger's girlfriend's drink, and Tommy Hilfiger, like, slapped Axl Rose. So, like, Tommy Hilfiger beat up Axl Rose. I mean, that kind of illustrates how tough of a guy Axl is. Axl, though, still one of my favorite rock stars. But, yeah, he's not that tough, really.
Is it true that you wrote much of the book while listening to one of my favorite perhaps self-indulgent early 70s songs, Elton John's Love Lies Bleeding, Funeral for a Friend?
Well, that album was one of my... That's the Goodbye Yellow Brick Road album. That's one of my favorite albums to write to. And that was a good album for this book in a way because, like, a lot of the songs on that record are about show business or they use show business as a metaphor for real life. And that's basically what my book is. You know, it's looking at these show business rivalries and using them as a starting point to talk about the world at large. So inspirational in that regard. But yeah, that first song, that Love Lies Bleeding, Funeral for a Friend, it's such an epic-sounding song that, like, when I hear that when I'm writing, it just makes it feel like I'm writing, like, War and Peace or something. You know, like, anything I write just seems super epic when that song is on in the background. So it's good for getting the juices flowing.
Well, it was a much more enjoyable read than War and Peace, I will tell you that. I absolutely love the book, and, boy, we could talk with you all day. It's great to chat with you this afternoon. Highly recommend your favorite band is Killing Me, What Pop Music Rivalries Reveal About the Meaning of Life. Stephen Hyden, thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, it was great. Thanks again.